Well, so welcome to Richard. He's going to, be part of the ensemble on Thursday. And tell us more at the end of the session about the talk.
Okay, so we continue with the morning session. Is the screen on?
Yep.
Okay, great. So our next speaker is Bill Unruh. And you have the floor.
There was my talk, you see. That's why it was TBA. Even I didn't know what I was going to say. So what I want to talk about is an experiment that a group of us at UBC did a few years ago by now, which was the first measurement of Hawking radiation from a horizon. In this case, it's of an analog black hole. Well, I'll tell you what that is. This is where it's posted. So as we know, back in 1972, Jacob Bekenstein suggested that there's some relationship between entropy and the area of black holes. Basically, what had happened was that John Wheeler asked Bekenstein the question, what happens to entropy when you have black holes? After all, if you throw a bunch of entropy into a black hole, it just disappears, and you therefore seem to violate the second law of thermodynamics, that the total amount of entropy in the outside universe decreases. That's, of course, not really a problem, because we know that a zero temperature heat bath is a place where you can basically throw an arbitrary amount of entropy into it, and a black hole is like a zero temperature heat bath. But at the same time, both Demetrios Christodoulou and more thoroughly Stephen Hawking had shown that black holes have this attribute. Christodoulou called it the irreversible mass, and Hawking recognized that it was actually the surface area of black holes. In classical general relativity, in which one has positive energies, the area never decreases. Well, entropy never decreases, area never decreases, therefore there must be some relationship between entropy and area. He, of course, had a number of other arguments to argue that this relationship was probably on slightly better footing than what I've just described. He ran into all kinds of trouble doing it. Bob Garosch pointed out some difficulties, etc., and Bekenstein had to invent new laws of physics, like entropy to energy ratios for bodies, etc., to try and save it. But nevertheless, he was right. Because a couple of years later, Stephen Hawking, in thinking about black holes and looking at quantum fields in the vicinity of a black hole, showed that the black hole actually wasn't a zero temperature object, but had a temperature proportional precisely to the surface area of a black hole. Sorry, had a temperature proportional to the inverse mass for a Schwarzschild black hole. And as a result, just using TdS equals dE, integrating up the two sides of the equations, you then find that since the temperature is proportional to the energy, that there would have to be an entropy to within some sort of additive constant, which was exactly proportional to 1/4 of the surface area of the black hole. So that analogy that Bekenstein started off with really seemed to work, and black holes really seemed to behave like thermodynamic objects. In fact, one can imagine building heat engines which use black holes in order to run the heat engine. This is an example of a little heat engine. We have out at infinity some source of high entropy radiation. We fill up the box with that high entropy radiation. We lower that box down towards the black hole. As we lower it, of course, we're extracting the energy, the gravitational potential energy, which is negative, so we're extracting that energy. If we manage to lower the box right to the surface of the black hole, then we would extract all of the energy in that radiation, and we'd have a little, then we can open the box, let the radiation drop into the black hole, getting rid of the entropy, and we therefore have a heat engine that we can use to run between, you know, this hot bath out at infinity and the black hole. Well, this was in fact the example that Bob Gorosh gave to say, look, regarding black holes as thermodynamic objects doesn't really work because I can seem to extract all of the energy in that entropy doing this. Thus violating the second law of thermodynamics, i.e. when I open the walls of the box, the entropy falls into the black hole, but of course the energy does, I've extracted all of the energy from it. Again, as I said, that's not really a problem if the black hole's at zero temperature. But what happens if they have a finite temperature? Well, what happens is the accelerating box sees itself, the surrounding, as though they're in a thermal bath. And that thermal bath, as Archimedes told us 2,500 years ago, that if you immerse something into a fluid, and this thermal bath is certainly a fluid, it will have a buoyant force on it proportional to the weight of the displaced fluid. In this case, the closer you bring the box to the horizon, the higher the acceleration on the box, the higher the surrounding temperature, the denser this thermal bath is, the bigger the buoyant force is. And eventually the box, instead of being able to lower it right to the surface of the black hole, the box will begin to float. And the tension in the rope will go to zero, and one can't extract any more energy from the box. When you put in the numbers, you find that that's exactly what you need in order to save the second law of thermodynamics, namely the ultimate efficiency of this thing is just the Carnot efficiency, where the temperature of the black hole that Hawking found is the temperature of the bath from which you have extracted the radiation is one of the thermal reservoirs, and the temperature of the black hole is the other thermal reservoir. So everything works, and the black hole really does act like a thermodynamic object. Of course, this whole raised the whole question of what is the entropy of the black hole. And there have been disputes now about this for 40 years, and they still exist, although some of us who believe that the entropy of a black hole is just sort of something fundamental about the black hole, that's becoming a small group. But I guess we're going to talk about that in the discussion period tonight. That's not what I want to talk about here. Let's go back to Hawking's derivation. And part of the problem with Hawking's derivation is it really makes no sense. It's perfectly mathematically correct, but when you look at the physics, you know, is just completely wrong. Because if you look at the black hole, so what this is supposed to be is the green stuff, time runs upwards, the green stuff is supposed to be matter that collapses to form a black hole. Here's the horizon of the black hole. And if we look at the light rays as they come in, the light rays that come in just before the black hole horizon forms here in the center of the star peel off exponentially from the horizon. So if one looks at radiation with some frequency out here, omega, and we ask, what's the frequency of that radiation in the initial state here? After all, in physics, what happens now happens because of what happened in the past. So we can trace whatever is being emitted here back to whatever the quantum fluctuations existed in the past. One finds that those frequencies are exponential in the time at which you actually look at that radiation coming out. So if one take a solar mass black hole and you look at the radiation coming out 1 second after that solar mass black hole is formed, you find that the initial frequencies of the quantum fluctuations go as that final frequency of the thermal radiation that's coming out times e to the 10 to the fifth times however many seconds we are after the black hole formed. Well, e to the 10 to the fifth is a very big number. So big that I don't even have to put units on it. Because whether I use Planck units for the frequency or I use masses of the universe, inverse masses of the universe as my frequency, it only makes some tiny little difference in that 10 to the fifth. At those kinds of frequency, one absolutely doesn't believe the theory. One doesn't believe that one understands how quantum fields, whose frequencies are e to the 10 to the fifth, that's e to the 10 to the fifth times the mass of the whole universe, so quantum fluctuations whose h bar omega is e to the 10 to the fifth times the mass of the whole universe, they're wandering in here towards the black hole, they're not simply not going to behave like a nice free quantum field in an unperturbed background geometry. Of course, if one could do experiments, they would be determinant. They would tell you what happens. You go ahead and you find a black hole, you find it emits thermal radiation, then you know that there must be something right in this argument. Even though, you know, there's something wrong in the physics, just as there was something wrong in Bekenstein's analogy, but the answer is right. Unfortunately, small black holes are hard to find. Now, a few years ago, I was very fortunate over a period of 2 weeks. We had one conference in just down the road here at Niagara Falls. And a week later, I was in Brazil at Iguazu Falls. The two largest waterfalls in terms of the amount of water going over them in the world. The reason this is interesting, well, I had a lot of fun seeing them, but is interesting because back in 1972, Dennis Sharma asked me to come to Oxford to give a colloquium about black holes, and I was trying to figure out, you know, how does one get across the idea of black holes to the audience? In 1972, black holes were relatively new things. Wheeler had only named them about 4 or 5 years before. The concept, of course, was much, much older, but almost everybody in the physics community ignored general relativity as being irrelevant to anything. So people didn't know what black holes were. And the analogy was, let's imagine we've got a world, maybe Terry Pratchett's disk world, in which we have a bunch of very smart fish. And this world happens to have a waterfall in it, and the waterfall is a very virulent waterfall in that at a certain point, the velocity of the water is faster than the velocity of sound in the water. Now, if one did this on Earth, of course, the height of the waterfall would have to be about 10,000 kilometers in order for the velocity of the water to be equal to the velocity of sound in water, but that's just a small engineering problem. In Discworld, of course, everything travels much more slowly, including sound, and as a result, one could imagine in the big waterfall at the edge of the Discworld that there is a place in which the velocity of the water equals the velocity of sound. Now, these fish, as I said, are intelligent. They're a bunch of physicist fish, and they're trying to understand their world. Unfortunately, or whatever, these particular fish have no eyes, you notice. And these little protuberances here are not fins, they're ears. They experience their world only through the sense of sound. And so they're trying to figure out what in the world is going on at this waterfall. Now, at one point, one of the poor graduate students who sent in to investigate this gets a bit too close and gets swept over this waterfall. What's going to happen to him? Well, if he shouted out to a supervisor out here, the supervisor would hear him, the sound waves would travel out and get to him. But if he shouted just as he crosses that horizon, the velocity of the water is equal to the velocity of the sound waves, so the outward traveling sound waves never get anywhere. They're like Alice in Wonderland running as fast as they can, but never actually getting anywhere. If he emits sound in this near region here, it takes a long time for the sound to get out, so the sound waves get base shifted as this fish falls across the horizon. Well, this is exactly the same thing that happens in black holes. As you fall into a black hole, the light that's emitted from you gets redshifted, so that by the time you hit the horizon of the black hole, out of which the light can never get out to the person on the outside, it gets redshifted down to zero frequency. Similarly here, the sound wave gets base shifted down to zero frequency. So this fish yelling for help, he thinks he's yelling, help! And all the supervisor hears is, hello. Of course, it's not clear the supervisor would do anything anyway. Well, this was a fun sort of analogy to have in a colloquium-style talk, and I didn't think much more about it until I had to teach a course in fluid mechanics at UBC. And one day, while I was preparing my lectures, I thought back to this little analogy and decided to take it a little bit more seriously and ask what would actually happen to sound waves if you had this flowing water. And what it turns out is that if you assume that the velocity of the water is irrotational, so that it's the gradient of some potential, that then the equations of motion of the perturbations in that potential obey a wave equation with coefficients which are dependent on the velocity of the water in the external velocity of the water. And furthermore, one can write this equation precisely as a metric, as though the waves were behaving, were a scalar field propagating in some background metric, where the coefficients of the metric, the time-time component of the metric, looks like this. And we notice that when v squared equals c squared, that goes to zero, just as we get on the surface of a black hole. GTI is just the velocity of the fluid, and GIJ is the flat space metric. And if we chose our velocity to be the square root of 2m over r, then this equations of motion for the sound waves would be precisely the same as the equations of motion in the Schwarzschild metric, where one uses the Pan-Levi-Gulstrand coordinates in order to write those field equations. One would get exactly the same equations. Furthermore, one can go through Hawking's argument line by line for these sound waves and get the fact that these sound waves should also emit thermal radiation for exactly the same reason as black holes do, where the temperature in this case is not the surface gravity, but is proportional to the derivative of the velocity of the fluid as it goes across the horizon. If the velocity of sound also changes as a function of position, that can also come in determining the surface gravity. The problem with this derivation is it has exactly the same problems as Hawking's derivation has, namely that you get these e to the 10 to the fifths coming in if one stays in the hydrodynamic approximation. But of course, we know for sound waves, we don't know what in the world happens with gravity. That's the whole problem of quantum gravity. But we do know for sound waves what happens. As the wavelength gets short enough, the sound waves no longer behave as in the hydrodynamic approximation. The atomicity of the matter begins to change the way in which sound waves propagate. And in particular, we know that there's a natural cutoff. You can't have sound waves whose wavelength is less than the interatomic separation, because sound waves are simply this collective motion of the individual atoms. So this gives one a hope of perhaps looking at this thermal radiation in a situation in which one has a natural cutoff and ask whether or not the phenomenon still survives this. So is this e to the 10 to the fifth an absolutely critical part of Hawking's derivation, or is it just some accident that is really unnecessary, even though all of the derivations we have basically have that in them? I gave a talk on this when I visited Texas for a few months. Ted Jacobson was in the audience, and this sort of infected his brain. And about 10 years later, he realized the crucial thing. I had no idea what to do with this sort of insight because I didn't know how to solve the Schrödinger equation for 10 to the 23rd strongly interacting fluid particles crashing into each other to ask what in the world the correct derivation is. It was Ted Jacobson who realized that the crucial idea was that the atomicity of the matter changes the dispersion relationship of the sound waves in the matter. As long as the wavelengths are longer than the interatomic separation, one finds that instead of omega being equal to some function of k in still water, or if the water is flowing with a velocity v, you get omega plus vk, this is the convective derivative, is equal to some function of the wave vector, is what the dispersion relationship of sound waves is. Whoops. Here are just some examples, the famous little balls on a spring, which we've all solved in our solid-state physics courses that we've taken, where you just get the sinusoidal variation of the dispersion relation of omega versus k. Or if you look in the books, liquid helium has a dispersion relationship that looks like this. Because people were confused back when they originally saw this, they had some ideas, partly due to Feynman, that this part of the dispersion relation, which is what they saw this part of the dispersion relation and this part, they had thought this had something to do with sort of vortices in the liquid helium. I think that's just wrong. It's just the ordinary sound waves. It's just that the dispersion relation of the sound wave has this minimum here, but this is now called the Roton minimum. And at about this point, you get the interatomic separation. The wavelength equals the interatomic separation. And at this point, the dispersion relation becomes a complete mess. The experiments that they've done with neutron scattering just become completely noisy in this regime over here. So we notice that these dispersion relations are not the dispersion relation that you get in hydrodynamics, which just have omega equals k, or omega equals minus k. I've suppressed the waves traveling in the opposite direction. So if one has a velocity, a background velocity, we find that that background velocity, the omega plus vk equals f of k, if we look at that with a sizable velocity, we find that generically there are three solutions for this. Here, here, this is a long wavelength solution, and these two are very short wavelength solutions of that dispersion relationship. But what's important is that the wavelengths at these crossing points is relatively long, and as a result, the continuum approximation, one doesn't have to worry about the atomic approximation at that point, that occurs much further on in the dispersion relationship, is still good. So for any frequency, and if one has a fluid which is stationary, whose flow is stationary, then we know that the frequency is conserved. And as a result, one finds that there are three, in general, three possible solutions for the wave vector, this one, and this one. This dispersion relationship here, if one looks at the group velocity, which is d omega by dk, one finds that the group velocity is the difference in slope between that solid curve and the dotted curve. At this point, the group velocity is positive, i.e. the waves are traveling towards, for example, towards the horizon. At this point, the group velocities are negative, namely the velocity of the fluid is dragging these waves away. Even though for both of these situations, the phase velocity is still not equal to, is still positive. Now, back in 1981, I published a paper in which I asked the question whether this might allow one to do experiments to look at black hole evaporation. I had a question mark in there. Now, Scott Tremaine said he has a little theorem which says that anytime you have a title with a question mark in it, the answer is always no. Well, this one is a counterexample to that theorem because I really didn't know whether or not this might make possible experiments. Obviously hard. The velocity of sound is 300 meters per second in liquid helium, or, you know, 1.5 kilometers per second in water, and trying to force something to travel that fast is very difficult. However, after something like 20 years, I managed to erase that question mark. But instead of giving it that title, this is the title that we gave it. It was a group of Silke Weinfurtner, who's now at ICTP and will be at Nottingham. Ted Tedford, who's a civil engineer graduate student. Well, at that point, he had just gotten his degree under Greg Lawrence, who is a civil engineer. Matt Penrice was an undergraduate student, and myself. Both Silke and I were theorists, and these two guys were sort of, they were experimentalists, civil engineering experimentalists. So it was an interesting collaboration. After I wrote that paper, many people have looked for various and sundry analogies, sound waves, surface waves, electromagnetic waves and waveguides or fibers, etc. Many, many suggestions, Bose-Einstein condensates. In all of these cases, the waves obey the same equations as Hawking's, i.e. there's an effective metric in which one can have a horizon at low frequencies, and they all differ in the way in which they behave at short wavelengths. So one of the questions one can ask is the Hawking effect really dependent on that ultra-short wavelength physics, or is the Hawking effect really a universal phenomenon? Now, I want to make a excursion here to quantum to basically simple quantum mechanics. This stuff is well understood by the people in quantum optics, but tends not to be well understood by anybody else. So what is it? Let's think about an amplifier. What's an amplifier? Well, an amplifier is a physical object which takes some input. In this case, I'm going to call it X. So this is supposed to be the input into the amplifier, some physical thing. And it's supposed to produce an output which is bigger than the input by an amount A, which is the amplification factor. Well, we want what's called a phase-insensitive amplifier, so it amplifies both the X and its conjugate momentum by the same amount. You can also have amplifiers where this is different from that. But the interesting ones are the phase-insensitive amplifiers, where both components of the input are amplified by the same amount. Well, if these are quantum objects, and after all, everything physical in the world is quantum, then if I take the commutation relationships of the output, I find that Y with P of Y is equal to the commutator of X with P, which is I, times A squared. we know what the commutator of x of y with p of y is. It's got to be equal to I. So we therefore have the theorem that all amplifiers can only have unit amplification. Well, wait a minute. Just this morning, I turned on the TV, and there was a little knob that I turned, and it got louder and softer. The amplification was certainly not equal to 1. I could change it. So what's wrong with this argument? What's wrong with this argument is that all amplifiers that really act as amplifiers have to have more than one input and more than one output. So the input here, I'm going to call the second input, I'll call Q, and its conjugate momentum of theta, and the output, which I'll now call, there have to be two outputs as well, the other output Z, and for the Y amplifier, we have to have A plus, so it amplifies X by an amount A, it amplifies Q by an amount B. The Z amplifier, in order that Y and Z commute with each other, and that Y and P of Z commute with each other, have to have AQ plus BX, but P of Z has to have a minus sign in the amplification for the conjugate momentum for the conjugate momenta of these X's and Q's. If one does that, then one finds that Y comma P of Y is A squared minus B squared times I, which of course we can set equal to I for arbitrary A as long as we choose B appropriately. Arbitrary A greater than 1 as long as we choose B appropriately. If we want A to be less than 1, we just make A as the same. We relabel A and B, and then we can have A having a value less than 1. So one can have an amplifier with an arbitrary amplification. The other thing is that these A's and B's are completely classically determined. I've talked about commutation relations here, but obviously we can figure out what A and B is by sending in a huge classical signal. We send in a huge classical value for X, and we find out what Y is. That ratio tells us what A is. Similarly for B. So the coefficients A and B are completely classically determined objects. However, if we look at this system and, for example, we feed in the vacuum state for X and Q, and obviously P and theta, and we ask what comes out at Y, what we find is that thermal noise comes out of the Y channel. Thermal noise with some temperature, the E over KT, which I call lambda here, is just related to the logarithm of the ratio of B divided by A. These guys are completely classically determined. So this tells us that the quantum noise of this amplifier is completely classically determined. As soon as I know what B and A are, I know how much quantum noise this system is going to put out. Now, if lambda turns out to be proportional to omega, the frequency of the output channel, then, of course, this is just a thermal spectrum. But in general, lambda isn't equal to omega. This is just the analysis using annihilation and creation operators. It turns out what's important in this is not the energy. One usually thinks about amplifiers as amplifying energy, but what amplifiers really do is amplify the norm. One can define a norm, which is just Q star P minus P star Q. This is obviously not positive definite. In fact, if some solution has positive norm, then its complex conjugate has negative norm. But these Q's and Q, these positive and negative norm solutions are important because when you quantize the system, It's they that enter into the guys that multiply the A's and the A daggers. The positive norm guys multiply the A, and the negative norm guys multiply the A daggers when one builds up a quantum theory. This is also true in field theory, where now we just get phi star pi minus pi star phi instead of q star p. This is usually d by dt in many situations. Whoops, this got an extra carriage return in there. But the important lesson I want you to take away from this is that the quantum noise is completely determined by the classical behavior of the system. Once you know what the classical behavior of the system is, and if you believe in the commutation relations, notice that nowhere in here did I talk about the Hamiltonian or dynamics or anything. All I talked about was the commutation relations. Once you believe in those commutation relations, and you measure the amplifier, thank you, then you get the answer. I better go quickly. So the black hole analogy we wanted to look at was surface waves on water. One has an obstacle at the bottom of the flow. At some point, the velocity of the water is faster than the velocity of these surface waves. That's the black hole horizon. There's another white hole horizon over here at the other side where the velocity slows down again. It turns out to be much more efficient to do the experiment with the white hole horizon, but that's simply the time inverse of the black hole horizon. So all of the physics should be the same at a white hole horizon as it is in a black hole horizon. The problem with the black hole side is that the emitted radiation is very long wavelengths, and our tank that we used was simply too small. So some of the waves that we used had wavelengths of 60 meters. Our whole tank was only 5 meters long. It's very hard to measure a 60-meter long wavelength in a 5-meter long tank. However, if one can send in very long wavelengths, i.e. very short, very slow waves coming this way, and measure the outgoing waves, which turn out to have very short wavelengths, as we saw from that dispersion relationship. So this was the paper. This is a sketch of the apparatus, a nice 19th century type sketch. This is a wave generator over here sending waves towards this obstacle, water flowing in here. This is the dispersion relation of those surface waves. This is the dispersion relationship in this region here where there's only one crossing. These waves over here have negative norms, so they're associated with the creation operators. Similarly, this is a negative norm wave here. These two waves are both positive norm waves. So we send in one of these waves and we get out these two waves. And the A and the B coefficients correspond to this will be the A coefficient, and this one will be the B coefficient. Notice that the group velocity here is towards the horizon. The group velocity here is also towards the horizon in the opposite direction. These two guys have group velocities away from the horizon. So these solutions, are incoming waves, those are the two incoming channels, and these two are the two outgoing channels for our A and B. To measure the surface, we shone a laser on it, we filled the water with rhodamine dye, which fluoresces in pink to a green laser, just like this laser here. We spread out the wavelength, we spread out the beam so that it was a very thin, very long sheet, and we could then take pictures and very accurately measure the height of the surface. This gives you a feeling as to what you could do by doing interpolation. These are individual pixels from the camera and the brightness from the individual pixels. Yellow is bright, blue is dark. If one simply took the center of the pixel as representing the height of the water, you'd get these red dots. However, if one interpolates, one also uses the adjacent pixels, one can get these blue dots. Each one of these pixels is about 1 millimeter in size. on the surface of the water. So what we can see here is that we can measure the height of the water to about a tenth of a millimeter. And when one averages over the whole wavelength, one can get the amplitude of these waves down to almost a hundredth of a millimeter. This is the experiment. This is an old wave generator. It generates waves traveling up towards the obstacle here, long wavelength waves traveling towards the obstacle. They get towards the obstacle, and we notice that there's a horizon here. The waves never get beyond that point. And we notice that there are these little ripples on the surface here, which turn out to be those short wavelength modes, which are dragged away from the horizon by the flow of the fluid. Notice that the phase velocity of these short wavelength modes is still in this direction, but their group velocity is in that direction. So this is an example. This is space, time. False colors are the heights. So this represents the phase velocity of the waves. But the center of that wave packet represents the group velocity. So we notice that in this regime, the phase velocity is still positive, whereas the group velocity is now being dragged away from that horizon of the black hole. This is looking just at the positive frequency waves that were generated from the horizon. Notice that they've got very strong positive group velocity, phase velocity, even though their group velocity is in this direction. Actually, more like that. In this direction would be their group velocity. And these are the negative norm waves whose group velocity is again out this way, but their phase velocity is negative. So one can tell the positive and negative norm by just looking at their phase velocity. And this is, therefore, a plot of three of the possible data points. That's 0.02 hertz, which represents waves which in still water would have wavelengths of about 60 meters. Notice that the outgoing waves have basically the same amplitude for positive and negative norm waves. They're the same amplitude, which is what one would expect for a thermal bath. And as the frequency goes up, the ratio of the positive norm to the negative norm goes down. So if we actually plot the logarithm of that ratio of b squared over a squared, or I call it beta squared over alpha squared, versus the frequency, this is these x's are the measured points. This is the best straight line fit. And we notice that those points really do look very much like a straight line. I.e., the spectrum of the thermal, the spectrum of the radiation of the quantum noise, remember that this ratio, the logarithm of this ratio, represents the quantum noise that's given off. The spectrum of that quantum noise is exactly a thermal spectrum. So this black hole or this dumb hole for surface waves would have exactly a thermal spectrum, with, in this case, a frequency of 1/8 of a hertz, which corresponds to a temperature of about 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin. Obviously, we're not going to be able to measure that because our water is a little bit warmer than that in Vancouver. We can compare that with the surface gravity, and this is the actual value that we got from that slope. This is the surface gravity as calculated at various points in the flow. And identifying exactly where the horizon is difficult. So if one assumes that the horizon is somewhere in this peak, one gets a temperature of somewhere between about 0.8 and 1.8, whereas the measurement was 0.085 here. So there's fairly good agreement between the surface gravity and the temperature that we measured for this radiation. Some people object that ask where the quantum mechanics in this, and the quantum mechanics comes in the fact that as soon as you know the amplification factors, these alpha and beta factors, then you know what the quantum emission is. If we were to spend $10 million and actually saw the quanta of surface waves, we'd obviously have to use a slightly colder liquid, come out, what would that show us? Well, if we got some other answer, it would tell us that quantum mechanics was wrong. That would, of course, be significant, but most of us would probably think that spending $10 million on the chance that quantum mechanics is wrong would not be a very good way of doing it. So let me quit.
So we have time for one or two questions.
What we learn from this about quantum gravity, something or nothing? Is
it, what do we learn about?
Quantum gravitational aspects of black hole. Do you think there's some lexicon to
talk about? What this tells us is that for this system, which is very different from Hawking's system, but it shares the feature that it has a horizon for long wavelength waves, is that this system also produces thermal the quantum noise in this system is also a thermal spectrum of quantum noise. Despite the fact that that you've got this dispersion relationship that cuts off the high frequency stuff, despite the fact that you've got stuff like turbulence, despite the fact that in this case there were also additional complications and that if you looked at the surface just as it comes off the obstacle, there were these undulations in it. Despite all of those additional difficulties, the thing still produces a thermal spectrum, which I think is quite amazing. And it really does indicate that the Hawking argument, even though on the first surface of it looks like it just is silly, is right.
But supposing you had found that it is not thermal,
right?
Then would you not have said that while this particular dispersion relation may be exceptional and there's no real reason to believe that this is the kind of dispersion relation that happens? And in other words, how much of this is a usual thing about the analog systems, right?
Right.
How much of it does it capture what is really happening in quantum gravity?
Right.
And
so do you have any comment? I think if one found that this system or analog systems like this did not produce thermal radiation, one would then start to really have serious doubts about the Hawking derivation. Because it really is silly physically. I mean, it just makes no sense physically, okay? So by breaking, pardon? Well, no, but for quantum gravity, there's some precise molecular structure, loops or whatever, string loops or your loops or whatever kind of loops there are, or whatever your theory of quantum gravity is, the structure at, once you get to the Planck scale, we know is going to be a totally different from a nice continuum theory. Something is going to go wrong. And if the phenomenon turns out to be dependent on what's going on at those short wavelengths, then you no longer believe the phenomenon at all. I mean, it just so happens that for black holes, everything works out right. I mean, that's a possibility. But that's not where we are now. We neither have experiments that show that, nor do we have any kind of a theory that really shows that. And so one would then really start to doubt the derivation. Now, it's so nice that you don't want to doubt it, which is why people didn't just throw it out when it was realized that Hawking's derivation really didn't make any sense, including these people sometimes. I remember when I published that paper, Experimental Black Hole Evaporation? The referee objected to the fact that I said there was a possibility that the Hawking effect didn't occur. There's so many derivations, analyticity. Well, analyticity is such a horribly strong assumption, and we know that analyticity is so incredibly unstable. you know, the function e to the minus 10 to the 99 x squared is absolutely zero everywhere, completely unmeasurable. If I do the Wick rotation, I get e to the plus 10 to the 99th x squared, which is huge everywhere, right? So analyticity is such a sensitive property that it has all the same problems that the conventional derivation has. You know, but I agree, it's so nice, the whole link with thermodynamics is so nice that none of us want it to be wrong. But that doesn't mean to say it couldn't be. Yes, sorry.
Can we learn with this kind of system about the nature of entropy?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, the thing about in the black holes, remember, was that the entropy arose because of the relationship between the temperature and the energy, that the temperature was a function of the energy. Obviously, for these kinds of dumb holes, the temperature, which is equal to the derivative of the velocity, has absolutely nothing to do with how much energy actually fell into that system. So one's broken the link between temperature and energy, and therefore one has no reason to expect any kind of entropic arguments for these analog systems. It would be nice to find an analog system in which one could make that link, but I certainly haven't ever been able to think of one. So unfortunately, no, it doesn't, except indirectly. I mean, one of the things that this suggests very strongly is that the thermal radiation is a low-energy phenomenon. It's got nothing to do with Planck scale physics. It's got nothing to do with very near-horizon physics. It's a long wavelength, you know, for a solar mass black hole, kilometer-long wavelength physics phenomenon. There's some sort of quantum instability in the black hole on those kinds of scales. And that then breaks a lot of people's, you know, talking about the entropy of black holes, you know, Susskind's, this little thin paste that lies on the surface of the black hole at sub-Planck scale levels that somehow contains all of the information of everything that's fallen into the thing. You know, I just suddenly realized that that really doesn't make very much sense. Pardon? As far as the temperature is concerned, yes. But I mean, the temperature is the link that we have between black holes and entropy. If one doesn't have the temperature, then the whole argument just completely evaporates. You know, so that temperature, the temperature is absolutely crucial for us, for those arguments about the black hole entropy.
So some more arguments for the panel discussion tonight, and I think we should now thank Bill again.
Thank you.